Good morning, everyone. I'm talking about the Anderson, and I will talk about the presentation use engine. This title is talk about the engine cover NI inhibitor and the angiotensin II receptor blocker. It's named ACI or ARB in diabetes. In a diabetes patients with late stage chronic kidney disease, reduce the risk for mortality and progression to dialysis. This is a study about the drug safety in special patients. And this is my outline, and I will talk about the study by the introduction by the sequence. ACI and ARB is first line antihypertension drug for the treatment of chronic kidney disease. And it's not only could lower blood pressures, but have the benefit of reduced urine proteins. Low blood pressures and reduced urine proteins could slow down the renal function decline. And there were a lot of clinical trials to demonstrating the effect of in patients with diabetes. Yet, the study focused on the patient with mildly renal insufficiency, but to the late stage chronic kidney disease patient, to continue use ACI or ARB or not, is still a question. It's a location, and it is confused physicians. Some researchers think that in late stage for patients, ACI ARB could make renal function deletions more, and the benefit of reduced urine protein was so important. In other way, this is maybe because patients condition serious, but consider ACI ARB effect. So physicians or other doctors depend on patient's condition, measured by renal function decline rate or some biomedical parameters to make a decision ACI ARB continue use or not. In some cases, it is uncertain. And it is lack enough evidence or study result to support this drug is safe or harmful. So in our studies, we use the National Health Insurance Database in Taiwan, and it is beginning from 1995, and more than 19% of 23 million in Taiwan covering that. And according to a National Health Insurance Payment Route, the CKD patients, if he or she could receive EPOs, if his creatinine rate is higher than 6 microgram per deciliter, or say his eGFR less than 12, he could use this drug. So we use the first day. For the CKD patients, use EPO as an index day. And by this way, we set up a population-based cohort study. If a CKD patient received EPOs in 2000 to 2005, and he without dialysis before index day or not receive renal transport, and he used antihypertension drugs during 19 days after index day, we were including them, and more than 25,000 person in there, and we exclusion aged less than 2 days and more than 100 years, or he dialysis all day during 19 days after index day, and without diabetes parents. There were 7,121 in our analysis. And we created exposure windows in these studies. The exposure windows is 19 days of index days. And during this exposure windows, we calculate the antihypertension drug use, and then the person, if patient with in use SDI or ARB level in with SDI ARB groups, if not, they were without SDI ARB group, and we follow up then to the last day in 1999. We also use cost proportion hazard models and set the event as clinical kidney disease or death without dialysis. Clinical kidney disease as a dialysis more than 3 months, and for 19 days in-day to the event or to the endpoint. We also adjust the age, gender, comorbidity as clinical heart disease, stroke, cancer. And compare the renal risk of CCB or beta blocker and other drugs to SDI-ARB. In the result, this is the demographic data. We can see that in the age and the comorbid parents, these two groups have significant difference. With SDI-ARB group, they are more younger and higher stroke parents, and without SDI-ARB, they were more cancer parents. And according to the result, between two groups, there's more than 17% into the clinical dialysis. The incidence rate in with SDI-ARB group is 17.8 per one case per one person years. And without SDI-ARB group, there are 18.8 per 100 persons. If we consider clinical dialysis or death, the IRR is 0.91. It means that SDI-ARB has less risk than without SDI-ARB. For adjust other confounders, we use cost proportion hazard model. In the result, with SDI-ARB versus without SDI-ARB, the hazard is 0.87. Okay. And in clinical dialysis or death is 0.91. In discussion, diabetes patients with late stage treatment with the SDI-ARB could reduce their risk for progression to dialysis or to of death. And we can say that SDI-ARB will save and without added dependent renal risk in late stage clinical kidney disease patient with diabetes. And in our study, we are the first study show that SDI-ARB are renal protective in the pre-dialysis stage 5 CKD patients. And it is very large and population-based cohort study. And we created exposure window to reduce the effect of survival bias. So we conclusion that use SDI-ARB is good and it could reduce the risk for progression to dialysis in late stage clinical kidney disease patient with diabetes. And we prefer more evidence to support physician decide SDI-ARB in late stage clinical kidney disease patient with diabetes. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to invite the speakers up here as part of a panel and welcome any questions that you have. Just as a reminder, in the Mr. Mackey had given us an idea of global health and the issue of counterfeit or multiple named kind of medicines and the problems that occur along those lines and some of the issues that are associated with it from a legal as well as a safety standpoint. And then we had Dr. Rock talk to us about the exposure of direct-to-consumer advertising on patient demand, and we learned a little bit about levels of media exposure and that impact on some of the demand. And Quinn Grundy talked to us about some of the nurses' interactions with industry and clinical practice and some of the, mixed ethical and emotional feelings that some of the nurses have with respect to that particular interaction. And lastly, GNC Sin Liu gave us the insights that treatment with ACE inhibitors and ARBs decreases the risk for chronic kidney disease in late-stage patients. So we've had a nice variety of things to present, and we've got an opportunity for questions from our speakers. So I'll entertain any. Yes.
This is for the first presenter. The counter-argument that applies to organization to deal with counterfeit, which is primarily that WHO, at least theoretically, operates on a democratic basis. It's transparent. The World Health Assembly is one nation, one vote. Anybody can go and look at the proceedings, whereas public-private partnerships, typically, people are not elected to them. And they take place in private without the kind of democratic debate that you find in WHO.
So that's an excellent comment. I think...
Repeat it.
I'm sorry.
If you would repeat it so that...
Sure. So,
or summarize.
Professor Lexton commented on why WHO, because of its, at least its governance procedures, internal governance procedures, are more transparent than the vast majority of public-private partnerships which operate under sometimes terms of confidentiality because the private industries don't want the data that's collected being shared or publicly disseminated. And of course, they're just not transparent bodies because they're not governed in the same way as international organizations. I think that's a very astute point. I would say the one thing that's challenging about the World Health Organization in the context of counterfeit medicines is that impact, their large group that they were looking at, which is criticized for a number of reasons, the very reasons that you bring up, is no longer really a viable model for them. So where are they going to transition to in this, because they do need to have a role in this particular issue. That's why we're trying to move towards more policy coherence across the different UN specialized agencies, because obviously enforcement is not going to be something their member states want them to engage in. But at the same time, public-private partnerships do have a role, maybe from a technical standpoint, of providing services, but not necessarily the governance for establishing the priorities, the policy priorities of where we should go in counterfeit medicines, because they could have very skewed opinions about how to enforce and what drugs to enforce, etc. I agree that public-private partnerships do have their limitations. In the online context, I think they are necessary just because so many of these facilitators are private businesses. So, and again, the public-private partnership model, maybe not specifically them, but including them somewhat so that they are accountable to the system and that they are actively surveilling for things that they're not actively surveilling for now, I think is important. But excellent point. I'd love to further debate it with you later on, but I think that's an excellent point to bring up, and public-private partnerships are not necessarily the solution, but we should incorporate them into the discussion. So thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? I had a related question for you, Mr. Mackay, as well, and it's a little bit more concrete. You had mentioned that some of the drugs should have been identified by the practitioners as being potentially counterfeit in one of your examples, like the labeling or something like that. What specific actions should one of those practitioners have taken had he or she had recognized that that was a potential counterfeit medication?
Sure, yeah. So in the case of Avastin, there was labeling that looked fairly suspicious because it was in a foreign language. And there's only one authorized manufacturer of Avastin in the United States, unfortunately. So generally, a practitioner who has knowledge, at least some base knowledge of these type of drugs, would find that suspicious. So what they could do is, of course, report it to the FDA. The FDA regulates biologics, drugs, et cetera. And the FDA would then do an inspection. And the FDA was the agency that determined that there was no API in the particular product. And FDA does have a, you know, a 1-800 number or something like that. It's not as proactive as it possibly could be, but they are involved in this space, and I think practitioners, from a liability standpoint, from a medical society standpoint, also have some requirement to make sure that their drugs are safe. And the reason why they bought it is because they got one of these telefaxes that said it was going to be a lot cheaper, and you know, it was going to be like a lot cheaper than what the reference price was, and that's why they bought it. So unfortunately, they're profiting because they're getting a reimbursement rate, and they're paying for a product that's lower, so they do have a responsibility there.
Great. Thanks very much. Other questions? Yes. So the commentary or the question is to any of the panelists, how and should a variety of different individuals, corporate, the media and the like, interact with these healthcare practitioners in terms of their education and how do they educate?
Yeah, well, what are the implications?
What are the implications? So what are the implications of corporate partnerships for educating these practitioners? Okay. Then
it's more what should health educators of health practitioners
Okay. So what should the health educators be teaching their students about those interactions with others? Okay. Yes. Quinn, you want to take this first?
My feeling, I think, is that education and health professional programs around industry interactions is needed, but that it won't necessarily be a solution to these ethical issues. The research shows that clinicians, students, and professionals, and researchers as well, are notoriously bad at detecting biased information. They never believe themselves to be influenced by marketing, although acknowledging that that influence likely exists. And so I'm a little bit skeptical as to the role of education as a primary strategy. That said, I think we do need to incorporate education as a denormalization strategy. So not as necessarily a solution to these ethical issues, but that these corporate influences on healthcare and the corporatization of healthcare in general, that needs to be on the health education agenda, really so that we can start to question some of these interactions and really what role industry is playing and its implications. So I do believe that education is necessary, but not so much to teach health professionals how to deal with them, but rather to denormalize these interactions in general.
Okay, I guess my feelings are a little bit different. I was actually, while doing my research, looked up a particular website. It was called Big Bucks, Big Pharma. And there's physicians, I think a particular physician in at Columbia University, and he's been spearheading a campaign to kind of eliminate the interaction with educate, but eliminate that kind of corporate interaction at an earlier stage, because when you're getting into medical school, by that time, textbooks, you're seeing pens, papers, they're giving these or exposing these potential or future physicians to everything earlier on. This physician, I forget the name escapes me, but if you ever watch the documentary, Big Bucks, Big Pharma, he's spearheading that kind of campaign to make sure that there is education about conflict of interest and things early on, before they even get to the stage where they can prescribe. And I think to some extent there needs to be some more of that, and you know, the conflict of interest kind of needs to stop earlier on. And then in terms of creating more ethics courses, maybe in med school, maybe in some of these other professional schools too, that would be, you know, a great educational start to a campaign.
So from my standpoint, I found the presentation fascinating, that you do some work on conflicts of interest and direct-to-consumer advertising. So one, for DTCA, I think we need to renew discussion about a moratorium on DTCA for new drugs, because a lot of these drugs are new products, they haven't gone through post-market surveillance, they're dangerous, Vioxx was advertised by Dorothy Hamill, So these drugs that aren't proven, they really have to, we shouldn't be heavily marketing them without some post-market data surveillance to show that they're safe and effective. And a lot of times these drugs are actually being pulled from the market, and indeed some of these products actually have black box warnings. So we really have to be cognizant of the fact that if you watch any DTCA, you know that the risks and benefits aren't being represented in the right way, because you still see the horses and you still see the bathtub and everything like that when they talk about the risk versus benefit information. From the conflict of interest standpoint and the academic educational standpoint, I think it's not necessarily similar to tobacco, but pharmaceutical industry, we're just seeing the Physician Payment Sunshine Act come into play. But that data is going to be ongoing, and it's even hard to implement now. What we really want to know is how much money was spent marketing, you know, years and years ago, because some of that action is being curbed. And what we need, I think, to a certain extent, is not for industry to be necessarily the primary educator of our healthcare professionals. It should be academic detailing, which has been explored. Of course, financing academic detailing is a separate issue. How can we finance it? How can the public sector provide more education to our healthcare providers? But I think we need to be proactive about providing the correct information, because industry is always going to have a conflict of interest. And how do we mitigate that? May be difficult, from things I've seen, a lot of the pharmaceutical industries are now moving, like you said, towards other healthcare professionals. They're moving towards medical scientific liaisons, who are physicians, who market to physicians now. So they're very dynamic in how they market, and I think, you know, to mitigate that is going to be difficult. That's why we need more counteractive measures.
In the back.
I would invite any of the panel members to comment on what, at least in the first reading of presentations, there is one actor, mainly the pharmaceutical industry, that potentially has a lot more money and translates that into a lot more power than any of, for instance, the revenue of individual drug companies is more than the revenue of most countries in the world. And so I guess I'd like people to comment on the power differential and where that plays in terms of doing any regulation in this area.
So you'd like the panelists to comment on the power disparity or power disparity within the pharmaceutical industry.
And eventually all of the other regulatory
bodies. Okay. Anybody?
Oh, sure. I'll take a shot at it. So while doing my research, I saw that, and I hope I'm answering your question. Yes, so the pharmaceutical industry has a lot of, their pockets are very deep. The issue being the United States, and I'm just giving you, not going on a tangent, the United States and New Zealand are the only two who, I guess they would be considered developed countries that allow this form of direct-to-consumer advertising. New Zealand, their FDA, or the equivalent of FDA, is kind of works in conjunction with the drug company, so there's really not a great distinction there. Within the FDA here, even with advertising, with different forms of advertising, they break it down into so many different levels. So there are reminder ads, there are different ads where they can't even, you're not supposed to say the name of the drug, but they can tell you what it does. So with all of this being said, a lot of the times what I've seen with the FDA is they send out warning letters, and there is another form of letter. One is a little bit more severe than the other. But by the time this stuff is marketed, this company has already got everyone's attention. They're making money, you know, they're changing up a lot of things. So again, if I could really possibly answer the question, I think the FDA needs to be a organization with a little bit more bite, a little bit more enforcement that could possibly come down on these drug companies a little heavier. At this point, you know, they're still significantly understaffed. And then there, you know, there are a lot of things that are just falling through the cracks. So, I mean, that's my opinion, and I think there could be a lot more done. And I think it needs to be something, maybe a bill or a change in regulations just to address these kind of things, and just to give them a little bit more power.
In response to your question, I think on a small scale, the ambivalence reflected by my participants is perhaps reflective of even the public at large. And I think culturally, we are still very much convinced that this industry is indispensable. And they've done a wonderful job of promoting, you know, the perception that their research and development is something that we cannot do without, and that these massive profits are required to sustain that. And so perhaps clinicians or researchers can be leaders in this, but I think before government or regulatory agencies can become a little bit more powerful, we maybe do need a cultural shift. And again, the tobacco industry is a wonderful example of an industry that has slowly fallen from grace in certain circles, and I think a campaign of denormalization among the public may help to promote regulatory efforts if that cultural shift can take place.
I'll just make one quick comment. I'd love to see a little bit more transparency, and not just the physician payments on China. Like, I'd really like to know how much they're spending on pharmaceutical marketing. Can't even really get a good idea of that. I mean, So there's a lack of data, I think, and that's critical. But I also think that one of the most important issues is we have to recognize the realities of the policy environment we're in. So for direct-to-consumer advertising, it would be great if we could just ban it, to be honest. But we have a commercial free speech doctrine here in the U.S. that's protected by constitutionality, by the Constitution. So I think that would be a difficult uphill climb now that we've already got direct-to-consumer advertising out there. But again, we are unique in that we're one of the only two developed countries that allows this form of marketing. So how do we effectively regulate it within the existing policy environment we have? But to be honest, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has pharma, they have big lobbying, and there are certain realities, I think, that make it difficult to do very, very aggressive regulation.
Thank you. Yes?
So two quick points. In 2004 in the U.S., $57.5 billion was spent on promotion. There's an article in PLOS Medicine from 2008. The other point is that with regard to educating health professional students, there's an NGO based in Europe called Health Action International, and together with the World Health Organization, they've produced a manual, I think there are about 8 chapters in it, looking at different aspects of marketing. And that manual can be downloaded for free from the Health Action International website, or you can write to them and they can send you it, the hard copy.
So the two points were that in 2004, a report that was published in 2008 said that there's $57 billion spent in advertising for pharmaceuticals. And the other one is that there is a group, Health Action International, who works with the World Health Organization, and they have a manual on marketing of pharmaceuticals that is downloadable at their website or accessible via writing to them.
Yeah, it's a manual that's designed primarily medical and pharmacy students, but it could be used for other types of health professional students.
So the manual is directed typically for medical and pharmacy students about pharmaceutical marketing, but it can be applied to other healthcare professionals. Great. Thank you very much for that information. Yes? So, did you want to respond?
Sure, yeah.
Just make sure you kind of summarize it.
Okay, sorry. And you were just mentioning how Interpol does have some interesting relationships with other questionable industries, especially tobacco, on the enforcement side, on the smuggling side for tobacco products, which should be muted. I mean, the tobacco industry claims there's this whole issue of tobacco smuggling, especially when, in relation to the plain packaging legislation we have coming up in Australia. But we do have a tobacco smuggling protocol that's being developed now. So that should mute some of the industry arguments, at least in that space. I agree. Interpol is more of a, their interest in law enforcement. So if you're going to do some sort of partnership between these three organizations, trying to leverage their individual strengths within international organizations, you do have to have that governance structure there. Kind of like we've already discussed, where there's transparency, where there's access to meeting minutes, where there's access to resolutions, where there's access to the decision-making process. Because unfortunately, the industry has kind of infiltrated a lot of these international organizations, either through funding. WHO's 80% of its funding is extra budgetary. So we really don't know the particular influence of industry actors in these spaces because we don't have transparency. So governance is a key component, and I would absolutely agree with you that if you were to develop a policy like this, we focus on governance and transparency and accountability throughout the whole process to all stakeholders.
Thank you. Time for maybe one more question. Well, if there are no further questions, I'd like to thank our panelists with a round of applause for their hard work, and appreciate them coming out, and appreciate everyone else coming out today.